Welcome to the podcast component of ArmageddonLetters.com, a virtual time machine back to the moment the world was nearly destroyed in late October of 1962. You can also follow us on Twitter at ArmageddonTweet. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. What we want to do right now is to play a little bit of a thought experiment with you. Imagine two things. One is that Kennedy is not shot in Dallas in November of 1963. Instead, he lives into old age, and by now he'd be about 95 years old. But he's a very smart guy, very vigorous. Let's imagine that he's in good enough health that he takes our class, that he's really interested in what he didn't know at the time in October 1962 and what he got wrong. And he did get a bunch of things wrong. He certainly got a number of things right. We are all alive here because of what he and Khrushchev and Castro did in a nick of time with a lot of luck. But as Jim reminds us all the time, it was these three guys that also got us into war. So let's think a little bit about, in a sense, Kennedy's motivation. Why would he want to take our class?
Okay, he takes Janet and Jim's Missile Crisis 101. And what he's going to learn is that he is part of a process that caused this crisis. He was a bubblehead. Khrushchev was a bubblehead. Castro was a bubblehead. These guys are inside their own bubbles, and they do not come out until they crash, till they collide 18 months after the Bay of Pigs invasion. And the basic mythology, Kennedy won. He made Khrushchev take the missiles out. Khrushchev zero. Castro and the Cubans meant nothing. Unfortunately, during this 18-month prelude to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you're justified in referring to this as sort of a trilateral sleepwalk. There's three people here who are not engaging with each other in anything like an adequate amount. And so what you're getting here, just to give you a few examples, Kennedy authorizes Operation Mongoose, which is essentially a state-sponsored terrorist program to try to beat up on Cuba, using as instruments of that aggression Cuban exiles operating out of Miami, Florida, or the area of Miami, Florida. Now, Kennedy doesn't for one second believe that these guys are going to overthrow Castro. They're not. There's only 4,000 or 5,000 of them to begin with, and there's 6.5 million Cubans. Fact number one. Fact number two is these guys, a lot of them are hooligans. I mean, they're as much in this for the adventure or the crime or the graft as they are for anything else. Loyal Cubans they may have been. Anyway, Kennedy's mistake here, though, is to think or to imply that the Cubans are going to see it the way he does, that it's no big thing. But, we now know, we've interviewed people all over the island of Cuba, and they did not take it well. You were blowing up their department stores. The El Encanto was blown up, and the biggest department store in Havana was blown up in downtown Havana. Cars are blown up, buses are pushed off roads, torched crops are everywhere. So it's a mess. Cubans conclude from this. Castro concludes from this. This guy, Kennedy, will do almost anything to destroy our revolution. Well, he was wrong. He wouldn't do almost anything. He was basically doing what he was going to do. And that was to keep these exiles busy while he tried to figure out what to do with them so that they wouldn't run to their Republican congressman and make life difficult for Kennedy, the politician. Now, Khrushchev, he's also in a bubble. Khrushchev's this hyperactive guy. He's always looking for the big act, the big solution, the thing that'll just solve all of his problems. And he says to himself in May of 1962, gee, why don't we put missiles in Cuba? I mean, we'll counterbalance the nuclear problem that we're having. We'll save Castro. We'll show the Chinese who's in charge in Latin America. That'll be great. Unfortunately, Khrushchev believed, I guess, and convinced himself that Kennedy would, he'd be a little aggravated with him, but he'd accommodate to it. Why? Kennedy would understand that now we can negotiate from a position of equality and we can begin to wind down the Cold War. Well, that is delusional thinking, if there ever was any. And Khrushchev, of course, is shocked when Kennedy is shocked. And Castro, thinking that the Soviet Union has now adopted Cuba and put it under its nuclear umbrella. Castro believes that even if the United States of America destroys us Cubans, the Soviets will respond by blowing the United States up. Well, this is lunacy, as Khrushchev sees it, because these nuclear weapons, like all nuclear weapons, you're not supposed to use them. They're just chess pieces in a global chess game. So this is how you go through this 18 months. Kennedy doing a little, but the Cubans feeling it a lot. Castro drawing the conclusion that Kennedy's going to whack him, which he's not. And Khrushchev getting the idea that Kennedy will get used to the weapons, it won't bother him, but he won't. And that's how it goes. And they get deeper and deeper and deeper into their dream worlds until the missiles are discovered, October 14, 1516, 1962, they're shown to Kennedy. Kennedy makes his speech, shocks the world, shocks Khrushchev. Castro concludes from this that Cuba will be blown up in a catastrophic war, and none of this has to happen. I mean, none of this has to happen, and yet they have so talked themselves into their bubbles that they don't know how to get out. And that's what makes the escape so miraculous. That's our short form of the lecture Kennedy would have heard from in the back of the class.
One of the first things he says to us is, listen, how do I know that I should believe you? So we go into a mini lecture to him and talk a little bit about our methodology called critical oral history. And what it involves is, in a sense, a clash and a interaction of three different kinds of knowledge and information, which we try to choreograph in conferences. And the first aspect is memories of former high-level decision-makers. And so we
crucial,
say,
yeah.
Mr. Kennedy, Mr. President, you actually could be part of our future research, our next conference even, if you'd like to, and if you're willing to do the homework. Because what we want to do is bring these people who had responsibility during the crisis to the table, and we give them a briefing book of over usually 1,000 pages, of documents from the time period to get them back into that time period, to get them remembering in real time what they were doing when they didn't know the outcome. That's a very crucial aspect of our methodology. And then we invite scholars who know the literature and so forth to engage in some discussion. So we have former policymakers asking questions to each other. Why did you do that? On the other side, it didn't make any sense to us. We thought you did it for this reason, and maybe they'll get corrected and say, no, we didn't. You were wrong. So it's a way of learning about what people knew at the time and what they didn't know at the time. This is our methodology of critical oral history. We combine the memories of former high-level decision makers with declassified documentation from all the governments and also with scholars. And in these meetings, what we have found out about the Cuban Missile Crisis is that it was even more dangerous than anyone, including JFK, believed at the time. This notion of 13 days is really a myth. Jimmy, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, there were 13 days. Kennedy started the myth because he had little calendars made up for his executive committee and one for his wife. With those 13 days, 16 through 28, were in bold, just to remind you that this was the crisis to end all crises. Well, that's how it felt, but it doesn't lead to any useful understanding of how it happened, why it happened, how you might avoid it again, because it leaves out, this is an 18-month crisis between April of 1961 and October of 1962. You do the arithmetic and you come up with about 540 days. It's a 540-day crisis. Without those, there's nothing happening in October. In other words, the 13 days that we're all familiar with, that Bobby Kennedy wrote a book with that title, Kevin Costner made a movie with that title, and so on, that covers roughly 2% of the crisis. 2%. Now, it's an intense 2%, but the focus on the 2%, the focus on how they pulled the rabbit out of a hat, doesn't tell you anything about how the rabbit got into the hat. We're talking about Castro's decision very early, April 1961, that Kennedy is going to liquidate the Cuban Revolution, and then it sets in train the approach to the Soviets respond, eventually the missiles, and so forth.
And JFK, our student, he's gesticulating wildly and saying, Castro was wrong. I wasn't going to destroy his revolution. I only wanted to make him uncomfortable.
Right. That's why I wish in 1992, when Fidel was with us for 4 days at a conference in Cuba, I wish Kennedy was there too, because he could have said, "Look, Fidel," he'd do it in a Boston accent, of course, "we weren't out to liquidate you. We were just out to rough you up a little bit." Well, Castro would then, of course, have said, "Yeah, well, it may look like that to you, but it certainly didn't feel like that down here on the island." What Kennedy, I think, would really and truly grasp is the original sin of the superpowers. That their original sin leading up to the missile crisis is that neither Kennedy nor Khrushchev nor any of their key advisors listened to what the Cubans were telling them, how it looked from Cuba, what it felt like in Cuba, what they thought was about to happen, what they saw as their role in the world at that point. And they had already convinced themselves, and Fidel Castro was a master at this, that Cuba, you little, Cubita they call them, little Cuba, you are about to become the hinge of the world. You are about to matter so much. You're no longer going to be humiliated with the Americans coming down with their particular form of imperialism, with their gambling casinos and their prostitutes and all that. No, not anymore. Cuba will be glorious. Fidel Castro said after Kennedy made his speech on October 22nd, he said two things. If they invade our nation, we will resist. Fact, point one. Point two, they will exalt our nation if they invade us. He's daring them to invade them because martyrdom at this point seems like the only really interesting viable option to just total annihilation for no reason.
Now, this is a big deal. Because in real time, and for decades after that, many of Kennedy's advisors and probably Kennedy himself would have said that Cuba in the missile crisis was, quote, a bit player, and that they were absolutely right to focus only on Khrushchev and ignore Castro. I think that Kennedy would re-examine that proposition and maybe have an idea that understanding Cuba's security concerns might be in the best interests of the U.S. to avoid a nuclear crisis. Basically, one of the main things we've learned in our research is that if you want a synonym for the word risk, use Cuba. Mm. Risk equals Cuba. That is, it's things that are going on the island that up the risk during the crisis. Very quickly in the crisis, Kennedy knows he doesn't want a confrontation. Very quickly in the crisis, Khrushchev comes around and knows that he doesn't want a confrontation. But the mentality in Cuba is very different, and it contributes to the ongoing escalation of risk during the crisis.
Yeah, the Cubans don't believe they have any choice. They're not saying we want a confrontation or we don't want a confrontation. We have a confrontation. It is taking place right now. The planes are flying over. Yes, they're taking pictures at the moment, but tomorrow they'll bomb, and if not tomorrow, the day after that. And then the Marines will arrive with nuclear weapons, and we will be just toast. That's how it looks from the island. And there's a line out of Bob Dylan, "When you got nothing, you got nothing to lose." So they have nothing to lose by trying to act honorably at this moment.
What's interesting is that Kennedy in real time is very aware that he does not want to back Khrushchev into a corner. He wants to give him a lot of exit ramps. He does not think at all that it matters that Castro is in a corner and he has no exit ramps.
Yes, good
That's
point.
That's a biggie that Kennedy would learn in our seminar. The other thing is that basically Castro believes that he knows and acts accordingly that Cuba is going to be destroyed, and that therefore if Cuba is destroyed, there is that phrase, which we've come to know now, called regime change, that it's really what the Kennedy administration wants. Now, Kennedy certainly wouldn't mind having a better leadership in Cuba, but in his mind, he's not going to go to war for that. But Castro has no idea of that.
Senator J. William Fulbright, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said at the time after the Bay of Pigs to Kennedy, essentially, they're a pain in your side, a thorn in your flesh, but they're not going to be a dagger in your heart. Well, you turn that thing around and try to convince Castro that the U.S. is only a thorn in his flesh and not a dagger in his heart, you would have a hard time. I'm just sort of thinking about Kennedy in the back of the room now, sitting back there raising his hand and saying something like, "You professors have given me a lot to think about. I'm going to come back next week and after I've thought it over and let you know what I think."
Well, and actually we're then going to say, "Well, Mr. President, we'd also like to give you an assignment. By next week, when you come in here, would you be willing to talk to our class about why it is in the best interest of large countries to listen to small countries, to consider the security concerns of small countries, to try to put themselves in the position of advisors to leaders in small countries? Would you maybe think about that and give us your opinion on that next week?"
That's it. Visit us regularly for more in the podcast series, as well as news about our new book, short films, graphic novels, and blogs by our three leaders, all three of them. And don't forget to visit us at facebook.com/Armageddon Letters. I'm Jim Blake.
And I'm Janet Lang.